Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Leonard Zeskind. He's president of the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights. He's author of the book Blood and Politics, The History of White Nationalism from the Margins to the Mainstream. He's a recipient of a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant. He is co-author of the report Tea Party Nationalism, a critical examination of the Tea Party movement and the size, scope, and focus of its national factions. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
I'm glad to be here with you today.
So your report, Tea Party Nationalism, is the result of a detailed study of the six different Tea Party factions in the United States. And it shows that they're not all the same in either ideology, structure, or size. Nevertheless, looking at the overall picture, what would you say that they do have in common?
They have a common sense of dispossession, of alienation from the United States. For the most part, although not completely, they're tinged with racial and nationalist concerns, and they are bound and determined, as everybody knows by now, to turn the election of 2012 into a Republican victory.
The Tea Party arose after the Republican defeat in 2008, and it was an effort by conservatives to some extent to distance themselves from the failure of the Bush administration. To what extent do they actually differ ideologically from the Republican Party, if they do?
Well, if you look at the Tea Party rank and file, you'll find that a significant percentage of them associate themselves with the Republican Party. Another smaller but still significant percentage associate themselves with more Libertarian Party-style politics, that is, a complete absence of state intervention in the economy. And others are probably still more radical still. They come from to the terrain of the white nationalist world, and they're trying to push the whole thing along. So it's a mixed bag. It's not strictly conservative in the sense of trying to maintain or preserve some status quo. They really are seeking in many ways to change the status quo, and they're not conservative in the way that you might normally understand that word.
What are the demographics of Tea Party membership?
Let's put it this way. Many people think of the Tea Partiers as a result of the unemployment levels in the United States, and we actually did a regression analysis in the report to show that there's no link that we could observe between high concentrations of Tea Party membership and unemployment levels. These are people who, for the most part, haven't lost their jobs. They're, for the most part, people who hold up signs that says, "Hunk if I'm paying your mortgage." They're angry at having to, quote, support people who made bad economic decisions like getting laid off. And they're go-it-aloneers who think that the economy's just fine if you'll leave it alone. They're overwhelmingly white. It's an overwhelmingly Protestant and Christian phenomenon. But it is a broad enough phenomenon to bring in all parts of the United States.
The Tea Party is against efforts to address global climate change. They're in favor of Social Security privatization. They're in favor of tax cuts for the wealthy. They're against regulation. They like free markets. And various factions of the Tea Party have received significant support from industry and, for example, from the billionaire Koch brothers. To what extent are they genuinely a grassroots phenomenon, and to what extent are they a pseudo-grassroots front for big business?
They're not a pseudo-grassroots front for big business. They do have some backers, and some factions have more backing from the corporate world than others. FreedomWorks, for example, which is well-known because of its connection to Dick Armey in Washington, D.C., probably does receive significant percentage of funds from the corporate world. But they are, what we found, one of the smaller Tea Party groups in terms of memberships. Tea Party Patriots, which is the largest of the national networks and has actually a membership that dwarfs FreedomWorks by several fold, doesn't appear to have much connection to this fabled corporate money. I think by focusing on the corporate money, we miss the actual character of this thing and tend to underestimate its significance. It's a problem that's rooted in American life, and we have to deal with it as such.
I was wondering what you think the roots are within our own political tradition of the Tea Party. I mean, they focus publicly on things like the deficit and the bailout and the stimulus bill and so on, but much of their vitality seems to come from taking a stand against illegal immigration. There is definitely a white supremacist element to it, although that's not the center of the Tea Party. They are focused on Christianity, so-called family values. Looking back over American history, what are the Tea Party's ancestors?
Well, some people point to the Goldwater campaign in 1964. I think there's a piece of that. You'll remember that the Goldwater campaign drew a significant percentage of voters in the South for the first time for Republicans based on its opposition to civil rights. I think it bears more resemblance to the middle American radicals that were attracted to the Wallace independent campaign in 1968 when Alabama Governor George Wallace won 10 million votes, many of them outside the South, in his independent bid for the president. I think that this is a middle American phenomenon that has a race base to it but is not racially explicit. And it's the white nationalists that are trying to drive them into becoming more racially explicit.
Tell us more about that. It has a race base to it, but is not racially explicit. What does that mean?
Well, I'll quote a white nationalist, if you will, allow me to, on this issue. He says, "We know that we can win the support of white people eventually because they'll pay $300,000 for a $75,000 house just to live among other white people." There's a element of our society, which we haven't gotten over, that sees ourselves in racial camps and sees us against them. And that is very much evident in the Tea Parties, although they will say, for the record, that it's a multiracial group and there are black Tea Partiers and Latino Tea Partiers, but the complaints are the complaints of middle-class white people.
One of the things one hears from these middle-class, angry middle-class white people is that they, quote-unquote, believe their country is being taken away from them. What do they mean by that?
Well, there is an element of truth to that fiction. There's an element of truth because the white monopoly on the presidency has been broken. It is true that in about 30 some years, this country will not be majority white any longer. It'll be white people will be a demographic minority in a nation of minorities, and in fact, the United States of the 1950s and early 60s, which held economic hegemony over the entire world, has watched our economy slip and the Chinese grow. What they have done is reify these phenomena into a form of nationalism that seeks to reestablish things that can't be reestablished. You can't put the genie back in the bottle. You can't get rid of the 14th Amendment, although a bunch of them would like to. You can't control the borders on immigration of labor if you're also shipping capital all over the world. So it's a problem without a solution by them that causes them actually to get more radical over time.
We're talking to Leonard Zeskind about his report, Tea Party Nationalism. There is a funny contradiction which none of them seem to really pick up on, which is that if you are in favor of unregulated free market capitalism, you also have to be in favor of having your own jobs being shipped overseas if labor is cheaper in other countries. But they don't seem to recognize that.
Well, there's a lot they don't seem to recognize. It's a narrow self-referencing point of view. One of the things that we found, and I think others have noticed this also, they have their own media, their own radio, their own television that they look to, their own books and pamphlets. It's an insular worldview that is in many ways cut off from the larger discussion. Self-consciously, when the larger discussion intrudes, they cut it off.
Explain to us the obsession with President Obama's birth certificate within much of the Tea Party leadership.
That's a stand-in for this whole nationalism conversation in which they've lost the monopoly of control over the presidency. It's a way of talking about the president in terms that are racially derogatory without, quote, being racially derogatory. Nobody's calling him in open the N-word, but it allows you to tell racist jokes and so forth and so on, and it allows you to carry on a discussion in which the president of the United States is not really an American. And that's what this is all about, who's an American and who's in and who's out and who they can control.
How do they feel about Native American Indians?
It doesn't enter into their worldview.
So they think that on some level, even if it's not explicit, the kind of narrative is that white people were here first and they own the country, and if they don't, they should.
Absolutely.
So these Tea Party groups, they attract, for example, at their conferences, which you and your colleagues have done an extensive amount of research, gone to some of these meetings and conferences, and while they may or may not be speaking, they're attracting all stripes of white nationalists, anti-Semites, outright racist, former and perhaps present Ku Klux Klan members, and so on. Do the Tea Party factions as the Tea Party openly embrace these people and their ideas?
No, actually, they embrace the ideas without embracing the white robes and swastika armbands. It is, as you point out, a self-contradictory phenomenon in which you can talk the talk but not walk the walk, an actual fact. But they increasingly sound like some of the white nationalist organizations. It's a disturbing phenomenon in that regard, and what it means is ordinary folks have to be able to stand up and say, look, this is what's happening, we don't like it, and we're going to do something different.
What kind of opposition is there, you know, explicit opposition to the Tea Party phenomenon at this point?
Not enough. There's not very much, actually.
Very interesting. I've been trying for some time to understand that middle-class white anger about which you write and this feeling that black people are somehow oppressing white people. I mean, there seem to be these crazy reversals. They talk about Obama shredding the Constitution, but not, didn't say anything about Bush. They talk about black people oppressing white, but not the other way around. And I wondered, I don't know if you feel like you can speak to the psychology of this, but do they really think they're superior to other people, or are they afraid that they're not? What's going on?
Well, that's a very complicated phenomenon, and I'm not a social psychologist. I will say this. They do dress their political movement in the clothes of the United States Constitution at the same time as they are seeking to undermine the 14th Amendment and birthright citizenship. Some of them are attacking the 17th Amendment, which allows for the direct election of the United States senators. Some of them talk about states' rights, but they want to undermine the notion of national citizenship. So it is in that sense talking two things at the same time, protecting the United States Constitution and actually undermining the United States Constitution. They talk about themselves as victims, racial victims. They have the terminology of racial victims at the same time as they hold all the perks and privileges that have come along with white majority status in the United States. So none of us are rational and sane in everything we say and do, but this is a particularly, if you will, irrational and illogical phenomenon at a certain level.
What is the role of anti-Semitism and also anti-Muslim feeling in the Tea Party?
Well, there is an implicit and an explicit anti-Semitism in the Tea Parties, in the sense that where you find people who talk about the United States as a Christian country, this is a fairly exclusivist outlook and so forth. But the raw anti-Islam sentiment that was mobilized around, for example, the mosque or the Islamic Center in New York and in other places, and is often directed at the president, the claims that he's not a Christian, he's really a Muslim, and so forth. This is part of the "we are at war with ourselves" outlook that the Tea Partiers have. They're at war with the rest of the country, and their outlook tends to turn others that are not like themselves into the enemy.
What would they like the country to look like? Would they like all brown-skinned people to just vanish?
I don't know that one. There's no racial utopianism in this in the Tea Partiers, in the same way that you might find it in some of the neo-Nazi groups. The neo-Nazis are fairly explicit about wanting to turn this into a white republic. The Tea Partiers are not. They're not explicit about that. They don't dream of an all-white world, and they do not cringe at having black people in their ranks. They like that. It means that they're real Americans. So the world that they would like doesn't exist and won't exist. And that's the piece that we have to remember.
The rhetoric of gun culture is common in their literature. To what extent do they advocate or practice violence or threats of violence in the way they present their politics?
I think that there's an underlying tremor of threat in there, but it's not a violence-prone movement in the same way that, say, the militias per se were in the mid-1990s. This is an attempt, by and large, to get mainstream support, and so they've shied away from gun waving and so forth, even while they talk about some of the same kinds of issues. The threat is that these folks look like average Americans. We did find Tea Partiers recruiting at gun shows, for example, but, you know, lots of people go to gun shows and political candidates show up at gun shows and try and win votes. The focus on guns isn't a per se Tea Party phenomenon.
When you were doing this report and you were going out there and immersing yourself in all of this, what surprised you? What was it like to actually get in touch with this whole movement?
Well, that's what we do at the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights. It wasn't so much surprising as affirmed what we were looking for in a certain sense. We saw it, the averageness of it, the Americanness of it, the normalcy of it. People go to gun shows and rallies, and they act just like ordinary Americans. That's the truth of the matter. You know, it's not like going to a cross burning or a Nazi rally. It's like going to the shopping mall.
And somehow it's all connected to Christianity and God, which in their view is a fundamentally white American phenomenon somehow.
Somehow.
So, okay, we have here several months ago midterm elections, and there were some Tea Party candidates that were actually elected. What were the tactics that the Tea Party used that were most successful in getting candidates elected to Congress?
They did an intense level of voter mobilization. The Tea Partiers were outworking the grassroots. They are a grassroots phenomenon, so they were outworking their neighbors and the people that they associated with. They had lots of little rallies. They had a fairly aggressive internet presence on Facebook and so forth. They're out there recruiting and working their recruits and mobilizing them. That was the difference, I think, in this last election. One side was, this is nothing new. the one side was all pepped up and had lots of energy and mobilized their base, and one side didn't. And that was the main difference why a bunch of them got elected.
So we have a Tea Party caucus in Congress. What positions are they taking?
Well, that's going to be interesting to see in the new Congress. We know that in the report, we looked at the members of the Tea Party caucus and cross-referenced them with members of the House Immigration Reform Caucus, which is the anti-immigrant caucus inside the House, and we found that there was a significant level of crossover, and a significant number of the people that were Tea Party congressmen were also signed up as sponsors of the bill to overturn the Birthright Citizenship Clause of the 14th Amendment. So in this Congress, the way it's shaping up, we'll see whether or not they hold committee seats and wield power in the Congress in a real way, or whether or not the existing Republican leadership sort of pats them on the head and says, wait your turn.
Their position on immigration is basically extremely hardcore. Some of the groups have links with the Minutemen groups. What do they think should happen to immigrants, legal and undocumented, in the United States?
They want to stop immigration. They want to send people back to the countries that they came from. They want to restore the status quo ante. It's an ugly and undoable proposition, and it's not designed in their mind to do anything more than just cut the United States off from the rest of the world as best they can. Their approach to immigration pepped up, got more energetic, if you will, after they had lost the battle over the health bill. And they joined forces with an already existing and significantly large anti-immigrant movement. And to a certain degree, those two things have become the same. Now, that's not to say that all Tea Partiers are the same as the Minutemen, or all Tea Partiers are as aggressively anti-immigrant. There's actually differences amongst the different factions on these types of issues. And what we will look for in the next year or so is the way that these differences shake out among the different factions and which ones grow and which ones don't continue to grow. The one thing that we would point out about the Tea Parties is that it's a changing phenomenon. It's different today than it was a year ago, and it will be different in 6 months than it is today.
One of the things that is so staggering about their rhetoric is how ignorant it is of history, of fact. And so it's like a combination of ignorance and anger, which seems to me has the potential to be very, very dangerous.
I wouldn't consider it ignorant. I mean, they're no more ignorant than the average American. And I think separating ourselves in that way and saying there's some people who know what's going on and some people who are just dumb, I don't think that's a good way to look at this. These people have an understanding of American history, which is not so different than the understanding that was pretty prevalent some time back. There was a point in American history, for example, where the elite universities taught scientific racism as the established facts of the world, that the white people were born to rule and they should rule, and the world will be better under the domination of the Anglo-Saxon. And that was accepted elite university belief at one time. So I wouldn't call these folks ignorant. I think that's a mistake.
The foreword to the report by the president of the NAACP says something along the lines that most Tea Party members are people of goodwill, and he encourages them to condemn the racist elements within the Tea Party. In your view, how fundamental is the idea of a white Christian nation to the vitality of the Tea Party movement? In other words, what would energize them if they were to truly get rid of the racism within their ideology and within their ranks?
Well, that's a problem for them. I think that Mr. Jealous was reaching out an olive branch to the Tea Partiers that has, for the most part, been rejected. They have, for the most part, continued to mobilize themselves along racial lines. It's a sad commentary on the state of the country and our situation today, and we all wish it was different, but it's not likely to change in any immediate future.
How do you understand the few black leaders in the Tea Party, like Bishop Jackson and Lloyd Marcus?
Well, I think that they understand themselves as real Tea Partiers, and we're not going to tell them they're not. If that's who they think they are, then that's who they are. And we're not going to certainly tell them, oh, you're not real Tea Partiers. Well, the understanding that people have of themselves, we can't speak to that. I'm not inside their heads, and I'm not going to try and be that way.
It just seems a little hard to understand that somebody who is a black leader...
It's very, very hard to understand, and it's sad, but it's not something that I'm prepared to say to this guy, look, you're being delusional. I'm not going to say that. He's got his own understanding of this, and I think that's his understanding, and I'm not going to be able to change it.
Are there many young people in the Tea Party movement?
There are some young people. There's a lot of Americans in the that consider themselves associated with the Tea Party in some way. So some of them are young people, but it's predominantly a group of older people and not predominantly a group of young people. The young people don't have the economic wherewithal that the major Tea Partiers have. These are people who are not hurting economically, and young people are just getting started in the world. So it's a different demographic, if you will.
The reason I'm asking is because I'm wondering if the education that the younger generation has had has given them a different perspective on life that would, even the children of the older Tea Partiers, prevent them from taking that kind of, for example, white racial superior stand.
They don't look at themselves as white racial superior people. They look at themselves as people who are behind the eight ball, who are being oppressed by everybody else in the country. So if you ask them, are you oppressed by everybody else in the country, that they'd say, yes, that's who we are, and you're making the rest of it up. It's an odd situation for sure, but that's how they view themselves.
What do you think is the greatest danger to political culture in the United States that the Tea Party poses?
Well, the greatest danger, I think, is that people of goodwill will sit back and let this thing happen to them. There's many, many people who don't like what the Tea Partiers stand for. And so far, they haven't manifested themselves in a way to show that they're opposed to the Tea Partiers. And that's really the danger, is that we'll sit by and talk about it a lot, but people won't stand up and say this is wrong. And that's really the part that's got to change if we're going to be able to salvage a rational discourse in the U.S.
And what movements, I know you said you don't see a lot of opposition specifically to the Tea Party, but what movements within the U.S. do you see as being able to mount that kind of opposition and stand for?
Go ahead. Everybody that has a sense of the goodness of the United States, everybody who has a sense of fairness about the United States has to consider themselves as opponents of the Tea Partiers, who do not see the natural goodness of the United States and the natural goodness of sharing and thinking about the common good. That's the issue, is will we be a nation of people who don't like each other and a group of people that are at odds with themselves, or will we be a country in which we share a common purpose and a common sense of dignity for all of us? And I think that's what we've got to think about.
You know, I can't help but see the connection between that way of thinking, in other words, a common purpose and the common good, and an environmental way of thinking, that commonality extends to the plants and animals and air and land and water that support us.
Well, if that's the way you understand it, then that's a good thing.
Tell us more, Leonard Zeskind, about the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights.
We were the Institute, IREHR. We have a website, irehr.org, and the Tea Party Report is at teapartynationalism.com. We were founded in 1983, and we're small. We're not a big outfit. We're not trying to be a big outfit. We're mostly a think tank looking at social phenomena in a way that encourages democracy and human rights and opposes racism and bigotry. That's our mandate. We have among us people who have written books on this topic and studied it thoroughly, and we have a purpose that says let's understand this in order to be able to counteract it more effectively. So that's our general outlook. We've been around a while, and we're looking for more young people to get more actively involved in it.
Leonard Zeskind is the president of the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights. He's the author of the book Blood and Politics, The History of White Nationalism from the Margins to the Mainstream. He's the recipient of a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant, and we've been talking about the report Tea Party Nationalism, which can be found on the website teapartynationalism.com. You can also find the Institute at irehr.org. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate your incisive questions.
Thank you. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Yoni Leiser. He is writer and director of the documentary film William S. Burroughs, A Man Within, which opens at the CCA here in Santa Fe this Friday at 6 o'clock. And Kathleen Gray joins me here in the Santa Fe Baking Company. She's a film and music producer. She was a friend and associate of William Burroughs. Welcome, both of you, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, Yoni, William Burroughs was an iconic, influential character of the 20th century, literary scene, art scene. He had a crazy, wild, intense life. What drew you to make a film about him?
Well, I first learned about him in my early teenage years, and I grew up in the suburbs, and I had a lot of difficulty, and I couldn't really relate to anyone that I had been any writers or people I had been introduced in school there. And I moved to the city, and a friend gave me a copy of Naked Lunch. And I was around 14, 15 then, and it blew my mind. That was my, like, diving point into punk rock, literature that I've been into ever since, into, you know, surrealist art, everything that kind of helped me and helped me through self-actualization. But it all started with Naked Lunch, which was such a crazy and diving point. So I guess that's how I initially got involved in his work.
William Burroughs was from an upper-class Midwestern family. He went to private schools. He went to Harvard. How did he become a part of the beat poetry movement with Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac and that early kind of drug culture that he was involved in?
You should Kathleen knew him, Kathleen, you have a question?
Well, actually, William maybe was the so-called founder of the Beat Generation. So he was their mentor. He was Kerouac's mentor and Ginsberg and so on. He never considered himself a beat writer. He considered the label beat to be a marketing term. He was he considered himself a free thinker, maybe a radical thinker in the sense that radical means root. He was trying to go back to the root of ideas that created civilization. So he was a writer, and he was very close with Ginsberg and Kerouac and Gregory Corso and all of that, and it became to be known as the Beat Generation.
Well, this is, and I'm not sure which one of you wants to answer this, but in witnessing Burroughs, and here he is from this patrician family, is the word that's used in the film, and one sort of wonders whether he was rebelling against it or whether he just was kind of cut from a different cloth in the first place.
Well, he, he was from the American Midwest, and he was from St. Louis, which was the home of T.S. Eliot, and I think he identified himself less as from a patrician background. He was from the Burroughs family, of the Burroughs adding machine and so on, but the fortune, you know, that fortune had been made. He wasn't technically an heir. He never would have inherited money from it. I think he related much more to the essential impulses in American culture, the Walt Whitman, the Thoreau, the Emerson, and that rather than this patrician side. He never considered himself, I don't believe, as an outsider, nor do I. He was a part of a very complex American culture. And on the road, Kerouac's On the Road kind of harkened back to Whitman's Song of Myself. They considered themselves essence Americans. And, in some ways, yes, he was a rebel, but he was a rebel in the sense that he was really looking, searching for his individuality and where his conscience lay.
We're talking about the film William S. Burroughs, A Man Within. Yoni, you feature in the film wonderful interviews with John Waters and Patti Smith and a lot of poets and artists and musicians commenting on his life. And what's striking to me is, and you say this yourself about your own life, is the incredible range of influence that Burroughs had. He was born nearly a century ago, that he had on generations of younger artists. And I was wondering if you could tell us more about that.
Well, I was just saying, it's interesting how history is saved and passed on through generations and preserved, especially, I think, in America. So I think I've met people who, I was saying, I met yesterday who talked about William Burroughs, and the only reference he had of him is his appearance in Gus Van Sant's movie Drugstore Cop. And it was so interesting to me that that was the only reference point that he had ever had William Burroughs, but because of that, because of my film, you know, he's starting to learn about him, and so many people I knew, you know, learned about him through punk rock bands that they liked that talked about him. But I think it's connected to the whole idea of, I don't know, oral history or passing on, you know, influence. But I think it's important for people to have kind of a recorded history within their own artwork and pass that on. I've always been interested in creatively documenting history in a history that's important, that's personally important. So I think that his pervasiveness in mainstream culture and underground culture and middle ground culture has been, you know, very important.
I mean, yeah, and I think one of the reasons that he has longevity, and Yoni, I do agree with your point of oral history, which is not often valued as much as it is important, as the transmission between person to person is really key in the transmission of culture. But your subtitle is The Man Within, and, you know, often Burroughs is known, yes, punk rock, the drugstore cowboy, heroin, homosexuality, but there was a lot that he also wrote. I would suggest an alternate would be The Man Behind the Mirror, because he really was reflecting the morbidity of the culture in many of his artistic expressions with gallows humor, if I might say so. But his premise was that really there's something basically wrong with civilization. There is a deep and profound sleep in the civilized world, and the proof is war. So he, you know, in his artistic output, he really reflected that and how morbid that impulse that ultimately leads to war can be. But the man himself is quite different that you portray so beautifully in your film.
He was one of the first people, I guess, to be really explicit about his homosexuality, but he also, as the film brings out, I found this fascinating, he really was not at all interested in being part of a queer culture either. How did he deal with his sexuality in a time when it was taboo to even mention the word, much less to be a queer man out in society?
Well, I think, like, you know, I faced some of the similar things growing up queer in you know, the 90s and 2000s, but I was nowhere near as tough as it must have been, you know, for him. I think he opened up so many kind of doors for people to cross over, and it was his writing and his approach to it was so unsafe and so unwholesome. And I noticed, you know, today within the kind of gay queer, maybe not necessarily using the word queer culture, because I think that's more appropriate, but the kind of mainstream gay culture that it's kind of just wanting to be assimilated into quote-unquote normal culture, and like we're normal, but you know, we happen to be this thing. I think he defied all boundaries. So why, I don't think there was anything, you know, normal. I mean, I hate using the word normal, and it's a totally horrible word to use, but there was nothing, I guess, constrictive or conformist about him. He didn't want to, you know, conform, whereas I think a lot of quote-unquote gay culture does. It's important to be dangerous, and, you know, him, Jean Genet, were kind of able to talk about sexuality in this kind of, extreme deconstructionist, transgressive way, which I get to, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Remember that Naked Lunch and Ginsberg's Howl were two of the last books, if not the last two books in the United States that were censored. And one of the ways that William got around what Mary Charlotte was asking about, this kind of anti-gay thing, was he left the United States. He went to Tangier and so on, and ultimately he came back. I mean, there's the to be labeled as a part of a gay culture is like woman's culture, pre-suffragette movement. He wanted to be considered not a gay writer, but a writer. You don't have black writers or woman writers or any kind of so-called minority writers. He wanted to be known as a writer and an individual and a human, and he was a great human.
I think it's an interesting point that you were making before, is there have been, up through the present, kind of different strains in so-called gay culture. One is, let's be like mainstream in every way. You used the word unwholesome before. Let's be wholesome and just do what everybody else does, but we're gay and not straight, but we're basically the same. Versus this, let's really do something else. Let's be transgressive and point out difference and use this as a point of departure to look at what's crazy about the society we're living in.
It's interesting, though. You see, like, within his work, he was able to, you know, when I read Naked Lunch, when I read Queer, and I was just shocked. I hadn't read things like that. And when I found out it was written in the 50s, I was blown away, because in the 50s it was illegal to be those things, you know? But I think I think that's a big part of who he was, and a big part of how he influenced people. But you see in his personal life, and I'm not so sure he was all that comfortable. So I think growing up that way, he wasn't able to shed all that much. I mean, Kathleen, you knew him, but I don't think he kind of was ever in a quote unquote happy relationship, right?
I don't know. I can't say that for sure. I believe that his relationship with his second wife, he considered happy.
Whom he shot in a moment of drunken stupidity.
Yeah. And, when I first met him, I met him here in New Mexico when he accepted an invitation to be the first speaker for an ecological institute on language as a control system was his subject. But one of the first things I wanted to know when I met him, and I too read him when I was 14, 15, Yoni, I read Naked Lunch, and this was the man on the planet that I wanted to meet. I wanted him to come to that conference. I picked him up at the airport. I had a flat tire. Nobody believes this, but he changed the flat tire on the way into Santa Fe, and I wanted to know what his relationship with women was before I really got to know this man. And so I said, well, what shall I call you, Mr. Burroughs? He said, call me William. I said, William, what is your attitude towards women? And he stared at me. We were out on a kind of walking out in the Bush, and he said, I killed the only woman that I ever loved. And he started crying, and I held him, and he just sobbed, and he told me about that relationship. And that was 1974. And we only talked about that particular incident once in about 1980. But that was before his introduction to Queer, where he describes that incident. But it marked him.
You know, oddly enough, there's a moment in the documentary, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about the documentary William S. Burroughs, A Man Within, which is opening this weekend at the CCA, where he says that this horrible thing that he could never live down and that he always regretted, namely shooting his wife, albeit by mistake, actually played a great role in his being a writer. How did that work?
Well, I think just like Kathleen was saying, I think, you know, or as John Giorno says in the film, you know, he has to fight his way out of, you know, a paper bag. I mean, you get that fine sense of, you know, I make films and I work on things because, I don't know if out of anger, but I feel stuck about something. I feel upset someone doesn't know about something, or when I have trouble, I think the whole idea of even anyone keeping a journal, you don't write in your journal, I feel happy today, look how wonderful things are outside. You write about what your difficulties are. But I think if you're a brilliant person and you're writing, you know, your difficulties, it can turn into something amazing.
Kathleen, Burroughs was in New Mexico. He went to, what, boarding school here and was kicked out?
He wasn't technically kicked out, but yes, in 1929, when he was 15, he went to, what was it called, the Los Alamos Ranch School, and went there for about 3 years. That school later was taken over by the U.S. government, became the Los Alamos Laboratory. But he was very eager, when I met him in 1974, to come back to New Mexico, because in conversations at that time, he had very fond memories of New Mexico. He learned to shoot here. He made some cultural contact with Native American culture. He had his first drink in the La Fonda lobby. And he really harbored fond memories of New Mexico. So I'm quite honored to be speaking about him now, years later, and talking about your film, Yoni, because that was part of the personal side of William. And by the way, there's a section in the film that is filmed in New Mexico where he's shooting the artwork. He's doing some of his painting artwork where he target practice on aerosol cans. That's taken with Stephen Lowe and his friend Wes in El Rito on a mesa there many years ago.
Well, and there is absolutely wonderful documentary footage and really great animations and music. The film itself is quite a work of art. Yoni Leiser is the filmmaker of the film William S. Burroughs, A Man Within. Once again, it's opening this Friday at 6 o'clock at the CCA here in Santa Fe. Kathleen Gray is a film and music producer, friend and associate of the late William Burroughs. I want to thank you both very much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
And Kathleen's doing a Q&A, right?
Yes, correct. Yeah,
Kathleen will be doing a Q&A after the 6 o'clock screening.
Correct.
Excellent. We'll see you at the CCA. And by the way, the website over there is ccasantafe.org. The number is 982-1338. And the website for the film is burroughsthemovie.com. Thanks again for being with us.
Thanks.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.